I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. This week, the USA, spending more on defence than the next nine countries combined, commemorated its failure to defend New York City and Washington, D.C. 23 years ago. While the attacks originated in CIA support for terrorists in Kosovo and Afghanistan, another 9/11 was commemorated on Wednesday in the Milton Friedman Economic Neoliberalism Flashpoint of Chile. On September the 11th, 1973, the CIA enforced a coup d'etat that would see the elimination of democratically elected leader Salvador Allende. For decades, it would be a template, an example for installing death squads, torture, privatization, and U.S. vassal states all around the global south. This week, though, the present boss of the CIA was not talking about mistakes. Ahead of the Trump-Harris debate in Philadelphia, he was in London, backing Israel and Ukraine on a sofa with a supine MI6 boss as they congratulated Zelensky on the Ukrainian invasion of Russia. And all this, as Kamala Harris said, she was proud to receive the endorsement of the man who first endorsed Ronald Reagan for president, Dick Cheney. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Doug Bando, former special assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan. He is senior fellow at the Washington think tank, the Cato Institute. Doug, thanks so much for coming on, as well as the debate between the two Israeli bankrolled candidates. There was the anniversary of 9/11, Chile, of course, and the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. What did you make, just prior to that debate, of so-called, well, certainly Muslims in Michigan would call her Holocaust Harris, saying she was proud to get the endorsement of Dick Cheney, George W. Bush's vice president, and someone who you know, probably?
Well, I was never a fan of Dick Cheney. I call him, you know, Dick, I had other priorities, Cheney. This is somebody who got five deferments to avoid going to Vietnam, but then once he became, exceeded draft age, he suddenly became quite a hawk. No, I think it's an embarrassment for the Harris campaign. You know, Democrats rightly vilified Dick Cheney back when he was running for office and he was promoting war all over the globe. Now, all of a sudden, they've decided that he's a wonderful statesman, and that to have him endorsing Harris somehow is a promotion of democracy and civility in America. To my mind, it's quite extraordinary. You know, his record is an odious one. You would wish the Democrats could, put him aside, just frankly, as many Republicans, have done so.
What's it like there? I want to get back to Reagan in a moment. I mean, on this show, I sometimes show the Salzburger's New York Times. There's a piece here on the front cover of today's New York Times. What the New York Times here is, simple act of pampering lets Ukraine's women show Russia hasn't broken them. That's the story on the New York Times. What is going on? I know Blinken, this is being recorded before any decision on long-range weapons, but he's given, another $0.7 of $1 billion worth of US public money, along with his British vassal puppet state. What's the atmosphere there? Because I know you and many other critical analysts, professors, academics, and presumably people who are keeping quiet in the security state firmament have grave doubts about the sense of this. Kamala Harris shut down Trump when he was talking about the chances of nuclear war.
Well, look, the Washington establishment, like that in Brussels and many European capitals, it's all pretty much the same. I mean, it's very much a triumphalist attitude. You know, I joke that the American Monroe Doctrine, means the U.S. has the right to interfere, up to any other country's border and probably into other countries. I mean, the U.S. has an extraordinary sense of its mission, of its unique role in the world. You know, people in Washington very much believe that. And, all of the kind of hypocrisies and sanctimony along the way, they just don't even recognize. So they talk about human rights in Iran, and then they, suck up to Saudi Arabia, provide it with weapons to kill thousands of Yemenis. Unfortunately,
there's peace. I should say on the Saudi point, there's peace now breaking out. Saudi Arabia opened its embassy in Damascus in the past 48 hours. There are deals with Iran,
which the U.S. has opposed. U.S. has been horrified by the fact that Arab countries have decided that the way to deal with Syria is to try to actually have a relationship with it, as opposed to try to fund guerrillas and toss it out of office. And Washington is horrified by this process.
Do you believe that Washington is destabilizing the governments here in the Middle East if any more rapprochement and peace breaks out anymore? I mean, aside from what's happening in Gaza.
Well, I think Washington is hesitant to do that because it has an awful lot at stake with you know, Saudi Arabia. It wants cheap oil. You know, the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia long has been very close, but they're unhappy with that. And they weren't happy with the UAE and other countries that have also talked with, you know, Syria and talked about, you know, changing policy. You know, the U.S. is never happy when other countries don't obey the Washington line. And what they found now is that even in the Middle East, it's very hard at times to convince their closest friends to maintain a line that is viewed as harmful by those same countries.
I mean, you're a close observer of these things then. If Kamala Harris gets in November, will it just be more of the same and she'll be told what to do by those so-called deep state, some would say the state voices? And would it make little difference, actually, if Trump got in? Because when someone flatters Trump, so we hear from memoirs, he just does, he enhances the swamp rather than draining it.
Well, I think Kamala Harris, I mean, I don't think she has much independent thought on these issues. It's not clear to me she has a lot of independent thought on any issues, but certainly on foreign policy have never been terribly interesting to her. You know, she was a state attorney general. She was a senator who focused on domestic issues. International issues, I don't think, have ever been something she cared much about. I don't see a likelihood of much change. She has said at least some words that suggest greater concern for Palestinians, but this is an issue where it's very hard to get any of the establishment Democrats to change their position. They are almost as bad as Republicans in viewing a Mideast policy basically is focused on what Jerusalem and what Riyadh want, and nothing else matters very much. Younger progressives in the Democratic Party are challenging that, but I don't think it'll make a lot of difference to her. I think Trump is much harder to predict. You know, on the Middle East, he's shown that he is going to do what Israel wants. He's likely to do what Saudi Arabia wants. Elsewhere, he might do something
different. Those are opposite, according to statements coming from Riyadh, though, obviously.
Of course. But that's the irony of the Trump administration. His first visit when he was president was to Riyadh. He, you know, participated in the famous sword dance and seemed quite entranced. You know, his you know, son-in-law wandered over to Saudi Arabia and talked about doing business deals. At the same time that Trump fully embraced Netanyahu, came up with his deal of the century, which was a deal of the century for Israel, not for Palestinians. You know, so he played both sides the last time. Probably won't change that policy again. But frankly, we never know. I think the one thing about Trump is he recognizes last time he got played by a lot of the people that he put into office. He wanted to get out of Syria. They lied to him about, you know, the troops there. You know, he wanted to get out of Afghanistan, and the entire military establishment resisted. I think this time he might be more willing to take action, put some people in the office who agree with him ahead of time. But I wouldn't want to predict where all of that's going to go. I think there might be some good decisions and there might be some crazy decisions.
I'll return to Trump in a second, but where do you think these Biden-Harris officials and Kamala Harris herself and Jake Sullivan and Antony Blinken and these people, where do they get their lack of fear of World War III from? They must know how many minutes it would take for a North Korean missile to hit Los Angeles. They know that Russia has more nuclear weapons than the United States. How do they manage to have so little, to have such little fear that the United States could be threatened by their policies of using Europe as a battleground in their grandiose schemes?
Well, I think the first point is that they see politics as supreme. You know, so they care about re-election. They care about making the case against Republicans. They care about making the case against whoever they're running against. So that tends to be their focus. It's not America's interest or the world interest. It's their own political interest. I think second, it's arrogance. It's a standing assumption that America is an exceptional country. No one really can resist America. They cannot imagine that another country would be prepared to challenge the U.S. They view the U.S. as having untrammeled power, military power around the world, backed by the world's democracies. You know, for them, it's very hard to kind of credit Russia with a willingness, perhaps, to challenge the U.S. Same thing with China, same thing in the Middle East. And I think that's where the danger comes in. When it comes down to it, they tell themselves that, well, look, the Russians really haven't done anything. They're a paper tiger. They wouldn't dare act. NATO's more powerful than them. you know, we're really important, without a sense in terms of how much this matters to Russia, the fact that Russia is not going to allow itself to be pushed around like other countries have been, I think it's extraordinarily dangerous. I think that the commentary by, you know, Burns, you know, in his, you know, Financial Times interview was extraordinary. He admitted that he thought in 2022, there was a chance the Russians would use tactical nuclear weapons, but he insisted we will not be intimidated.
This is Bill Burns, head of the CIA. Bill Burns, head of the CIA, former ambassador to Moscow. Why? Yes. What happened? I don't know whether you know him. What would have happened to Bill Burns? Is he being blackmailed? Because I think he's been widely respected in Moscow and around the world as a diplomat. What happened to him when he became the head of the CIA in Langley?
Look, I think that what's happened here is that he's walking a very narrow line. You listen to the rest of the interview, he was much more cautious on certain things than you would hear from Blinken, you know, from Sullivan or from Biden.
Sorry. He applauded the Kursk offensive. By the time of this interview being broadcast, obviously there won't be a Kursk offensive, arguably. He called it a significant achievement and said that, yay, Ukraine has invaded Russia. How great. Kursk, a symbolic place, of course, because of the battle with the Nazis.
But he didn't predict exactly how it was going to turn out. I think that he played a game there. This is the problem. Are you going to serve an administration or not? I don't know him personally, so I can't speak to his personal views. But it struck me that if you listen to him, you listen to Blinken, you get a slightly different sense. Blinken, I think there's no sense of reality. Burns, I think that there was. The problem is he's out there speaking on an international stage. It shows the problem. Even if you're a fairly sensible person, you get pulled into this kind of international machine. You get pulled into the establishment, what's been called the blob in Washington. It's very hard to escape it. I'd love to know what he's saying privately. I'd love to believe that he's giving them serious advice as opposed to being a cheerleader. I don't know. But I think this is the, you know, you look at the people who serve Trump. You know, what is it like to work for Donald Trump, you know, as president? I think this has to be a very strange experience. Should you do it or not? You know, do you defend the president or not? In Washington, you're expected to be loyal. I think Burns is doing that. My hope is that at least internally, this is someone, you look back at his 2008 memo, it's quite famous, where he warned the Bush administration, expansion of NATO is viewed by everyone in Moscow, not just Putin, as being a direct threat to their vital interests.
Released by WikiLeaks.
Yes, he told that administration that. So we know that he understands these issues. You know, it looks to me like he recognizes he can't publicly disagree. My hope is that internally he's presenting some of these views that he presented in the past.
Well, we don't know about it. And in fairness to Blinken, maybe privately he's saying, actually, I'm looking like other members of the Biden-Harris cabinet to post-regime employment in arms company consultancies. Is that really running the policy rather than the benefits and the happiness of the American people?
Look, I think it's an important issue. I don't think American foreign policy is made, you know, by the industrial complex. I call it indeed, you know, university military-industrial complex. I mean, media. A military-industrial complex, but I think that it reinforces it. Lots of, you know, general officers, guys with stars on their shoulders when they retire, end up as consultants. They end up as on boards of, military contractors. These are people who end up on retainer at Fox News and other things where they're expected to spout, very conservative, very hawkish views. I think it reinforces the process. If you want to be successful after you leave office, you know, you end up, you don't dispute the party line. And I've run into that myself of people I've debated on TV who, after the lights went off and the cameras went off, they admitted that what they were saying was a complete lie.
Doug Bando. Doug Bando, I'll stop you there. More from the former special assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former special assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan and senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Doug Bando. Doug, I interrupted you in part one when you were explaining how people privately tell you that what they say in public as regards the the eternal wars of the United States is often quite different. What do you think, then, is the next few months as regards the war in Europe? I mean, what do you think should happen? I know you tweeted about this, the disgraced former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. What should happen to him? He's been calling for, obviously, illegal weapons to Israel, and is also calling for Ukrainians, more young Ukrainians, to join up and get killed, arguably, in the meat grinder. Why have you urged that Boris Johnson enlist in Zelensky's army?
Well, it strikes me that people who want war should kind of enjoy the benefits of it. I think the same thing for Lindsey Graham, for example, a U.S. senator who favors basically every war that one can imagine. You know, these are the folks, they want to send other people off. They do extraordinary damage around the world. And I think what's striking about these wars is the number of civilians who die in other countries, that the United States, the UK, Europeans are not the ones paying the price. Ukrainians are paying the price. Russians are paying the price. And the long-term costs of this, I think, are just devastating. Look, we need peace there. You know, that, I mean, I've been very clear. Vladimir Putin is an aggressor. I think he was wrong in attacking Ukraine. But we have to recognize allied leaders, the United States, Europe, NATO, all share the blame in this. They were utterly irresponsible. The expansion of NATO, despite the assurances they made to the contrary, despite the knowledge they had from people like Burns, that this was an incendiary issue, it was an issue of extraordinary importance to Russia, that essentially we are fighting to destroy Russia by sacrificing Ukrainian lives. I think it's disgusting. I think it's an awful policy. And over the long term, it's a destabilizing policy. We need to get the war over. I think that requires the US and Europeans to talk to Russia. It needs to, what kind of a new security structure can be created? Ukraine has to be neutral. I think that's the reality here. But protect its sovereignty, allow it to join the EU. What kind of a system can we create that Russia can live with, that protects the Ukrainians, that ends the war? Instead of pouring more money into it, more weapons into it, and prolonging the fight, we have to be looking for ways to try to end the fight.
Given the 2008 memo released by WikiLeaks about now CIA Director Bill Burns, some would say Putin should have gone in a lot earlier to protect the people of Luhansk and Donetsk, arguably. What about Europe, Western Europe? You know, there was some media speculation, I think on Bloomberg, that the United States is going to rapidly realize that the growing global South countries, the BRICS countries, Asia, this is the future. How have you been able to explain to yourself as to the suicidal economic policies of Western Europe as they self-sanction and so on the altar of this Washington policy of war, proxy war in Europe?
Look, I think this is a result of dependency on the U.S. As long as you expect the U.S. to defend you, as long as you're willing to turn your security over to the United States, suddenly you find yourself vulnerable. You don't want to view an alternative way. You go along with the United States. I mean, look at Germany. The rapid increase in energy costs, the impact on the chemical and other industries. Look at the fact that, as far as we can tell, Ukraine attacked the Germany's Nord Stream pipeline. I mean, this is an act of war.
Or Bill Burns and the CIA.
Yes, it would not surprise me that together, that it was not just one, it could very well have been more than one. I mean, that's an act of war. Yet Germany has to swallow it. The Poles have told the Germans, shut up. Prime Minister Tusk basically said, you shouldn't even, just shut up about this. Don't talk about it. Now, this is extraordinary. I mean, the Europeans are, what's happening to their economies, the political, fighting within, the fact that, you look at politics in Germany today, where the AfD is number two in the polls. Look at, France with this fractured electorate, where the RN and Le Pen, are in a, the next president could very well be Marine Le Pen. The transformation of the political systems, the Europeans are paying a very heavy price. And they're, of course, the ones who most need stability in Europe. They're the ones who most need the war to end. They're the ones who most need to have a positive relationship with Russia in the coming years. It won't be easy, but for them, this is critical. The U.S. is an ocean away. It's easier for folks in Washington to say, would you be so kind as to ruin what we view as a competitor of ours? You guys pay the price and we give you directions from afar. This is a disaster, frankly, from a European standpoint.
Yeah, or Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France and Tara Wagenknecht, of course, in Germany. I mean, I do have to ask you, as I said, you're a special assistant to Ronald Reagan, and you've written about how détente with the Soviet Union was opposed internally by very strong forces who wanted to destroy Ronald Reagan and his desires for a peaceful outcome and a kind of ending of the so-called Cold War. Presumably, Trump, who's been parading RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard around, both of whom share your views, I suppose, about the catastrophic consequences of wasting hundreds of billions of dollars of American public money on things to be blown up in over the bodies of 100,000, 200,000 Ukrainians. He will face huge pressures internally if he becomes president in January. Should he wish to wind down this catastrophic war in Europe?
Well, I mean, I am not a fan of Donald Trump. I mean, there are lots of reasons to be very concerned about him coming back to the presidency. I mean, I worry about a revenge presidency. But what I want to give to him is that, unlike other presidential candidates, in 2016, he talked about the U.S. committing aggression. You never hear that from other candidates. And when in office, it was clear at different points he was hesitant to engage in killing people unnecessarily. They proposed to have a revenge or a reprisal for Iran downing a drone, and it would have, killed 100 people or something. And the report is that internally he asked, why should we kill 100 Iranians because they shot down a U.S. drone? So I do think that, you know, Trump is a very complex character. I think he's very flawed. But at least I do have a one sense that at some point the humanity leaks through in a way that I don't think that Biden gives a flip. I think that Biden, you know, does not sit there and say, oh, I don't know, should we kill 100 Iranians? He's quite happy to do so. You know, that at least gives me some hope that if Trump is in office, that he is more amenable to the idea that we've got to end this war. I mean, we're not talking about 100 Iranians dying. We're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of Ukrainians dying. These are supposed to be our friends. So my hope is that at least he comes from a slightly different perspective. Harris will be part of the establishment there, part of the blob. I don't see her really resisting it. Trump, if nothing else for the fact he's contrary, might be willing to take it on. I think he learned from the first administration, he better appoint people who work with him, not those who oppose him. I mean, I still worry very much about where a Trump administration would go, so I'm not endorsing it. But at least on foreign policy, there's some hope, I think, that he might try to be different in a way that I think Harris is going to be more of the same.
Well, what actually happened to you personally, Doug? Because, you know, I was looking up, there was a scandal about Jack Abramov, and, you know, he's not someone famous back then for peace. These days, by the way, it wouldn't be a scandal. As regards payments, I don't even know how that even is a scandal if you look it up. What happened to you personally? Because, you know, back in the day, so you were working with Citizens for America, festivals in fascist UNITA, Angola, supporting death squads in Latin America, all of this. And now you say the key issue, one of the key issues for the American people, I suppose, apart from infrastructural investment, and they are related, is peace, peace in our time. Why is that?
Look, I've always actually been a peacenik. I didn't work for Ronald Reagan because he was hawk. I worked for him despite the fact he was a hawk. Look, I'm a political libertarian. I'm very much, I like free markets. I like a small government. You know, that from that standpoint, a lot of what he said is I liked, and I thought he was the best of the candidates who was out there. I wasn't happy with his foreign policy. When I left the Reagan administration, I edited Inquiry magazine. If you can find it, I mean, we came out for the nuclear freeze, for example. We were against the invasion of Grenada. So I've always been very much on the non-interventionist side. You know, along the way, I've worked with a lot of different groups on economic policy. I disagree with them on other things. I've long believed in drug legalization. There aren't a lot of people who believed in that before recently when pot, marijuana has been legalized. So I work with whoever I find. You know, these days, over the years, I've just come to believe much more that the issue of war and peace is the critical issue. That all these other issues, you know, while, you know, I care about them, I care more about the fact that people are being killed, Americans and foreigners. My nephew is a SEAL. My father was in the U.S. Air Force. I care about military personnel. I don't think they should be sent into stupid wars. And what I see today is the U.S. government, U.S. officials are utterly irresponsible and reckless in their foreign policy. They get Americans killed. They get hundreds of thousands of foreigners killed. Look at Iraq. Look at Yemen. So just over the years, I've grown much more convinced that that issue has to be addressed. Lots of people in America argue for a free market. Some I like them, some I don't. There aren't nearly as many people who say peace is the priority. That's what I've tried to dedicate the rest of my career to.
And haven't you been amazed then, though the so-called mainstream media may not reflect it, by how your viewpoint is now shared by more and more people? We have a cavalcade of former military officers on this program, former U.S. officials. We've seen it. They're on social media, I suppose, often banned. More and more people are starting to recognize how it works with making America great again, as it were. I know you're not a fan of Trump, but how it is to do with making the United States a greater country, getting away from these wars.
Look, what I've always found is the kind of middle officer corps were always very serious about these issues. And you could talk to them. They took them seriously. These are the people who commanded troops. These are the people who lost people in the field. These are the people who wrote letters home to the families of soldiers who died. I have a very good friend who retired as a colonel in the Marine Corps, who was sent over to Iraq, sent to Afghanistan, sent throughout the Gulf. And he told me that, you know, over the years, he became convinced of my views, that having served, seeing what it was, seeing what happened. And I think that the military is a logical place for this. These are people who, for the most part, they don't want to die for stupid things. And they actually don't want to kill foreigners. They want to serve America. They want to do a greater good. And a lot of them have come to the realization U.S. foreign policy is not directed at that. So I'm very hopeful in that sense that we've seen military after 20, 30 years of disasters. A lot of these people are looking for a change and they're willing to speak up. You're right. Very hard to break through the mainstream media at times. But I think they're out there and I think they are a very important voice.
Doug Bando, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed genocide here in the Middle East. We'll be back turning to Gaza and Jerusalem on Monday's show with Israeli-US Holocaust and Genocide professor Omer Bartov. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.